So I hope this will basically be a physics talk, so please pardon my mathematical accent. So the outline will be a connection between band theory, an old condensed matter physics subject, and K-theory, an old topological field. Then I want to talk about topological insulators, once I've introduced this background, and superconductors and how to understand them from a particular perspective. Then I'll get to this beautiful classification, the Kataev table, which discusses the symmetry classes which classify the single particle physics of topological insulators and superconductors. And I should also call this the Ludwig table. Andres Ludwig from the physics department here arrived at essentially the same conclusions in a different way by studying the edge physics and Anderson localization rather than the bulk physics, which Kataev analyzed. And on the end will be discussing Majorana fermions. And their braiding statistics. And I'll be doing this in 2D and in 3D. And this is sort of the new and surprising part, because normally one doesn't think you can braid in 3D, but there's an interesting paper on the archive from a few months ago by Keough and Kane, proposing actually very concrete condensed matter realization of this sort of, quote, 3D braiding. And many of us at Station Q have been trying to understand their paper in different ways in the last month. So what is band theory? Well, band is basically the single particle spectrum of a Hamiltonian as a function of momentum. So an ancient subject from the 60s, late 50s, and I don't know, 50s and 60s, I think it. Certainly very practical in developing semiconductor physics, making cell phones work and all that. What is K-theory? Well, K-theory is the study of vector bundles. Sounds mathematical. So what are vector bundles? Well, here's one. This is a real line twisted over a circle called the Mobius band. Another vector bundle familiar, very familiar to physicists, is the unit vectors in two complex dimensions. We call it the three sphere, the unit vectors in C2. If you divide out by phase, then you get what physicists call the Bloch sphere, which is just a copy of the usual two sphere. This is a bundle. It's not literally a vector bundle because it's fibrous, the circle, the unitary, one-dimensional unitary group, but you can easily associate a complex line to that. So this is basically your most familiar example of a complex line bundle. Now, it sounds like these two subjects are quite different, so how can they possibly be related? Well, sort of a hint of things to come is that if you have a periodic system, an insulator is basically described by a Hamiltonian. Again, all this is the single particle description. We're thinking about single particle states of fermions, and an insulator is characterized by having a gap, so that if the Fermi energy is adjusted properly, there'll be a definite set of filled states, a gap, and then there'll be empty states up at higher energies. So in an insulator, it's possible that this gap has a global structure. It may twist as you move around the Brillouin zone. So a very concrete and dramatic way to see this is to take a system in which there's some translational symmetry. So you might have a torus Brillouin zone. And over the torus, it might be that as you move from momenta to momenta, the filled states, which I'm shading darkly and the unfilled lightly, the filled states may swirl around as you move around the Brillouin zone. They may describe a non-trivial vector bundle. And this is exactly what is described in condensed matter physics by the TKNN invariant for integer quantum Hall effect. So Thales and his collaborators were able to understand the integer quantum Hall effect by looking at translation along a magnetic lattice. So a lattice where holonomy around the each box is an integral multiple of 2 pi. They're able to understand the quantum Hall effect as the twisting of the filled states, the twisting of this projection operator. In mathematical terms, this is called C1, first Chern class. The TKN invariant is the first Chern class. So this is the new feature. I'd say band theory in the last 5 years has had a new lease on life. It's become very exciting again because people have realized that there are global properties of bands as you move around either a periodic Brillouin zone or perhaps even continuously.
What is twisting? What is the fiber?
The fiber is so in other words, what you do is you take your Hilbert space and you decompose it as a direct sum of momenta of Hilbert spaces. This is basically just Bloch's theorem, and then the Hamiltonian is also written as a direct sum over momenta. And then at each point in the momentum torus, you have a separate Hamiltonian, and then if you set an energy level, that divides the spectrum into filled and unfilled, and they may twist. And it's the twisting of this as you move around the torus that's being measured.
How does that differ from a spherical Fermi surface?
How does that differ from a spherical Fermi surface? My guess is that the characteristic class is unstable for a spherical Fermi surface.
These are insulators are the gap. You know, Fermi surface is a gapless situation, so.
Well, that's true.
With a gap. But if it's spherical set of filled states, then a gap.
Now I understand what you're saying. You're just saying take a Fermi surface and at each momentum discuss which states are filled and then the states rotate.
Yeah.
So now you'd like to So now you're proposing to set up a vector bundle. I mean, if we want to try to make this analogy, you'd like to construct a vector bundle over this dual space, you know, the space of momenta. Now, the point is the fiber would not be defined if you had higher energy than the Fermi energy.
Yeah,
and the fiber wouldn't be defined if you had less. So you wouldn't have, first place, first difference is you wouldn't have a bundle over the dual space. You'd have a bundle over some, you know, surface. But I think it is an interesting thing to discuss, you know, what the tangent bundle of the sphere looks like. I mean, tangent bundle of the Fermi surface. And that's why I said that the invariant would be unstable, because the tangent bundle to the sphere does not have a Chern class, it has an Euler class. And K-theory is the study of invariants of bundles that are stable. But maybe that question bears more thought. So, I just kind of got right into the talk and I didn't tell the usual joke. You're supposed to relax the audience, so here's my Witten joke. So Witten said that string theory was a bit of 21st century physics that fell into the 20th century. And I'd like to describe topological insulators, which, you know, are some connection between band theory and K-theory, as a bit of 1960s physics that fell into the 21st century. Because it is very striking, K-theory goes back to 1957, and this is sort of, as I understand, sort of the heyday of band theory too, and that it took somehow an extra 50 years before people noticed that the two are related. So we're not working hard enough. Okay, so So let me come to insulators, and particularly insulators that may have a topological aspect. So I already said that basically what characterizes an insulator is a gap between valence and conduction states. And I'd like to give, as an example of this, so you'll understand what I'm talking about, BCS mean field theory. So this is an example of an insulator according to this definition. Because there's a gap as you move across the momentum spectrum. But you know what this example is supposed to point out, the reason I didn't begin with polyacetylene or something like that, which is an insulator whose with eigenstates in terms of electrons, is you may have to play with the Hamiltonian. What I want to be discussing, what's relevant to the Gataev classification, are free systems of fermions which have a global gap. And it's not necessary that the system be free in the obvious basis. You may have to do like the Bogle-Yubov transformation to find the correct quasi-particle basis to write it as a free Hamiltonian. But if you can...
Not the obvious, it's just the targeted one.
It might not be, yeah. Yeah, so for me, I'll be talking about basically single particle physics, which means free Hamiltonians. There'll be fermionic Hamiltonians, but the basis might be slightly unusual. A second example will be in the topological insulator realm. This will be mercury telluride. And all I'm going to comment right now about mercury telluride is its symmetries. So it has a time reversal symmetry, and it has a charge symmetry. But I choose to write the charge symmetry together with the time reversal symmetry, because for the mathematics, it's going to be very important that when we square these symmetries, we get minus the identity, not plus the identity. So I'll consider the symmetries in this combination. And the other thing that's going to be important to understanding the system in terms of the Gataev table, which I'm coming to, is its dimension. So the dimension is equal 2 for the system, the topological insulator system. So right now what I'm going to give you is a completely cookbook way of sort of trying to understand the properties of mercury telluride, you know, what it might mean to be a topological insulator. And then I'll explain why this cookbook formulation works. So the cookbook is you write down these homogeneous spaces. So these are quotients of one Lie group by another. And they're actually very beautiful homogeneous spaces called symmetric spaces, and they're on the Cartan list. And the first one you write down is O over U. Then secretly it's loop space is what you write down next, which is U over SP. Then P over SP cross SP cross Z. SP over U over O over O cross O cross Z O. Now if I've written 8, then I'm good. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, now this is sort of the start of the table at the top. And because this is actually 8 out of 10. There are 10 stable families of symmetric spaces. And you notice I didn't write dimensions after these Lie groups. Normally you might write like O2n modulo un. But we're interested sort of in the behavior of these when you have n large. N will play the role of number of bands, sort of hidden lower shells. So if you want to ask families of symmetric spaces which have this sort of stabilization structure, then it turns out there is the real and the complex family, and this is the real family. So we've written down most of them. And for reasons which I'll explain shortly, one always starts here, and then one asks how many symmetries there are that's square to minus 1, and one hops down the table according to those, and then one asks what dimension you're in, and that's 2, and you hop up the table, and you're back where you started in this case, in this example, and that means that two-dimensional insulating systems with two symmetries of this kind are somehow described by this space. And what's interesting about this space for us at the moment is just it's pi zero. The connected components of U over O, there are 2 of them, and it just has to do with whether the orthogonal transformation has determinant plus or minus 1. And what this means is that somehow in this world, let me erase the outer circle. The fact that there's a Z2 means that there are sort of 2 types of insulators with time reversal and charge symmetry in dimension 2. An example of one is gallium arsenide. An example of the other is mercury telluride. So this information, which is this Kataev table information, doesn't tell you, in other words, it isn't a compound. You don't localize a compound in the table. You localize a choice.
This space is supposed to be the Brillouin zone?
Sorry? No, there's no Brillouin zone anymore. What are these spaces? Yeah, but you have to wait. This is the way I'm organized this. I give a lot of thought to this. The way I'm organized this is we just surf through one example, which entails no understanding. It's just like you teach a freshman to differentiate, and then we go back, and we fill in the understanding after you've seen the table used once.
You can teach a freshman to differentiate anyway.
Even here. Okay.
So these are just spaces.
Yeah, these are
nothing to do with space.
No, okay. So the point is these spaces will tell you things about the deformation class of the Hamiltonian that describes a given physical system. And basically you write I'm jumping ahead, but if we write a free fermion Hamiltonian, a summation I over 4 summation aij gamma I gamma j, where these are Majorana operators, then because the I's out here, this is a real skew symmetric matrix. Okay. So this is a good way. So actually, since David did ask this and it's a legitimate alternative, let me do this like the honors course. we'll have the understanding first, not the cookbook. So the point is, there are these things called Majorana operators, which are made from the ordinary creation and annihilation operators. Okay. And if you're dealing in a system that doesn't have charge conservation, then it's appropriate to write it in terms of Majorana operators, because writing in terms of these would presume a conservation that isn't there. So I'm not taking charge conservation for granted, and actually I'll shun the term particle hole symmetry, which for me is just a way of saying there is no charge conservation. So if you want to write the most basic fermionic Hamiltonian without making any symmetry assumptions, you should write it like this, where this is a real skew symmetric matrix. Now, this real skew symmetric matrix might have other constraints on it. It might have to commute with other Clifford operators. And that's what the role of symmetries will be. If it commutes with an operator that squares to minus 1, like time reversal matrix, then it turns out that the space of these is different than the space if they don't commute. So let's first figure out what the moduli space of these A's is. So each AI, this is just a real skew symmetric matrix, it can be so-called, I don't know if you call this diagonalized, it can be conjugated by an orthogonal matrix until it's in a form lambda 1, minus lambda 1, lambda 2, minus lambda 2, and so on. You can block diagonalize it like this. And if you only want to know the deformation class of the Hamiltonian, you can do what they call spectrum flattening. You can assume that each of these real numbers, lambda, is just 1. So up to spectrum flattening and rotation, there's only one thing, only one choice for A. And actually, such an operator is really just a complex structure. If you think that this is an operator on R2n, you're just saying what J is doing, okay? So you can ask, what's the moduli space of complex structures on R2n? And that's pretty clearly O2n modulo un. So that first symmetric space is the possible fermionic matrices with no symmetry. Now, if they actually obey a symmetry, if they obey time reversal symmetry, then this is the correct space of matrices that obey that additional symmetry. If they obey two symmetries, you go down here. Now, what's less obvious is the role that dimensionality plays. It turns out the dimension moves you up in the table. Now, why is this? Well, there's an assumption here, you know, which may not be literally correct, but the assumption is that our matrix is a local operator. And if the states correspond to positions in the system, then we assume that there's a radius of interaction, or at least some rapid decay. Now, this is a new algebraic problem, because if you want to know what the topology is of matrices that obey some symmetries and have certain decay characteristics with respect to a spatial distribution of their indices, then it turns out the answer to that problem is to move in the opposite direction in the table. Every spatial dimension moves you upward. And there are two ways of understanding this. One is very sophisticated, I would say, mathematically. It's an isomorphism in K-theory that says K are the nth K-group corrected for dimension of a space X is isomorphic to the K-group, sorry, the space of any space crossed with sort of a twisted sphere. There's some isomorphism in K-theory like this, which corresponds to this rule. But there's for physicists, there's a more direct explanation. Oh, I'm sorry. N is only on this side. So in other words, if you want, in most interesting cases, N is zero, actually. If you want to know the connected, discuss the connected components. But the point of this isomorphism here is there's something called the suspension isomorphism in any generalized cohomology theory. And the usual suspension isomorphism would have a plus here instead of a minus. But this isn't actually crossing with the standard sphere, but this is crossing with a sphere that has some invulatory symmetry on it, which is what's appropriate, you know, when you translate what time reversal symmetry is doing in a spatial context.
If you start with something that has no discrete symmetries and dimension 2, how do you go up?
Oh, the table is periodic. It wraps. It's mod 8 periodic. Yeah. So I think to explain why you go up with dimension, I think the way for physicists to understand this is to think of sort of a generic Dirac Hamiltonian, which is summation over I the xi gamma I plus a mass matrix. And now, the point is that if these, you know, since we're trying to form an insulator, we're trying to construct a system Hamiltonians with a gap, it's very important that these things to be called mass terms should anti-commute with the gamma matrices. I mean, anti-commute. You know, it's because if you have two operators that anti-commute, it's like if you have lambda 1 sigma x plus lambda 2 sigma z, and you ask for the eigenvalues of this, if you square it, because sigma x and sigma z anti-commute, you'll miss the cross terms, and this will become lambda 1 squared plus lambda 2 squared times the identity. So the eigenvalues of this will be of the form square root of lambda 1 squared plus lambda 2 squared. So it's sort of an echo of this phenomenon that that the mass matrix anti-commuting with the gamma matrices is what actually makes it a mass matrix, enables it to open a gap.
I guess we're confused because the normal Dirac equation has gamma matrices. Gamma I are just the four gamma matrices.
The four gamma. Well, we can have any number of gamma matrices. I mean, by gamma, I just mean matrices that anti-commute with each other and square to plus 1.
Right.
And we could have Clifford algebras in every dimension and representations in all sufficiently large dimensions for these algebras.
Your mass is
gamma
5
there? No, this is gamma 0.
Gamma 0.
Or beta. So, so you already have Hamiltonian as alpha dot p plus beta.
So, I mean, the overall point of looking at this sort of ansatz of a Dirac equation is that if you have spatial directions, you probably have pieces in the Hamiltonian of this kind, and they correspond to imposing additional anti-commutation relations in addition to the symmetries. But these anti-commutation relations have the opposite sign when you square them. See, time reversal symmetry, for instance, as a matrix, when you squared it, is minus 1. And this will be plus 1. And it turns out that minus 1 moves you down the table, and plus 1 moves you up the table by a well-known identity in Clifford algebras, you know, which says that Clifford algebra PQ is isomorphic to Clifford algebra P plus 1, Q plus 1. Where this is, P is the number of generators in the Clifford algebra that's squared to minus 1, Q is the number that's squared to plus 1. And this equivalence of Clifford algebras is sort of embodies this duality between symmetries which square to plus and minus 1. So you should think of space directions as...
P is the number of
EI. So you have a Clifford algebra which is generated by E1, through EP, and then EP plus 1 through EP plus Q. And these guys square to minus 1. So EI squared equals minus 1. And these guys, E square to plus 1.
Is that supposed to be P plus 1, Q plus 1 on the right side?
Oh, P.
Above.
P plus one. Thank you. Thank you.
Could you give a hint of what time reversal is doing on the insulator side?
It basically means there's no magnetic field. I mean, it like before I was talking about the quantum Hall effect, there's an example of an insulator, integer quantum Hall effect. Yeah. It's an exotic insulator where their time reversal symmetry is broken by the magnetic field. But in this theory of topological insulators, it's extremely important that there not even be magnetic impurities.
Why is it in particular elements involved? It seems
so
pretty.
I don't know. Maybe Leon should answer why mercury telluride doesn't have what magnetic moments in the nucleus or something.
Is that the question?
I mean, is that unique in that way?
It's not unique. It's just mercury is very heavy. Not that many semiconductors are very heavy elements. And orbit coupling is important. So
yeah, yeah.
Heavy elements are important.
So all you were saying is there's no magnetic field. That's all this is saying.
Well, okay. So I think I should answer your question, and then Leon can adjust my answer if necessary. But I sort of made a digression to answer David's question, but now I sort of want to get back to what I was saying about mercury telluride, and maybe that'll contain the answer to your question. So all I said in this kind of cookbook fashion is if I look at two-dimensional insulating systems which obey time and charge time reversal and charge conservation, then all I know from looking at this table is that there are two examples of such systems. But I don't know that mercury telluride is in case A or case B. That requires further analysis, okay? It just means there will be two
examples, you mean two classes.
Two deformation classes of Hamiltonians. Oh yeah, because you could move around in the periodic table and substitute. There'll be 10 to the 40th different chemical compounds or something, but there'll be two groups according to this classification. So, So what I'd like to do is think of a model Hamiltonian.
What you haven't said so far with differentiates the group.
That's what the two cases are.
Yeah.
Yes, right. That's now. Okay, so we're going to look at a model Hamiltonian, which contains a spin orbit coupling. And I'm going to plot the strength of lambda in this direction. And let's imagine that we have an S and a P orbital, and when we take spin into account, so this is L equals 1 and L equals 0. When we take P into account, this representation will split, and what I'm drawing is I'm plotting the energy at zero momenta. And this is something called band inversion, where the energy of the P band at some point actually gets larger than the energy of the S band. And this is associated with a virtual mass, M, which plays the role of a Dirac mass in the previous discussion. And if and mercury telluride is somewhere over here, and gallium arsenide, for example, is somewhere over here. So it's a question of whether the effect of Dirac mass is positive or negative. And that's what controls these two classes, M greater than 0 and M less than 0. So the interesting case in the Z2, the exotic case in the Z2 classification, is the band inverted case. And now, which side of this erases? it's not symmetrical.
So, I mean, you just explained that those two are continuously connected.
But the gap disappears here. This is not an insulator at this moment. There's a Dirac point here. And that's a place where the system in two dimensions has a Dirac fermion. And as Sholong was explaining to me just before we started, that's a a place where the system looks like sort of half of graphene in terms of its band structure. It has two Dirac cones.
Chiral.
A chiral half.
I mean, it's not chiral because in 2+1 dimension you don't have a chirality, so it's just you pick. It's half of graphene because graphene has four Dirac cones, two valley, two spin. But here there are only two.
You don't count it as the same deformation class if you go.
No, I don't. I mean, because we're discussing insulators, and if we're able to deform through the general Hamiltonian, then everything would be connected to everything else. Yeah, in fact, something I should have emphasized, went through rather quickly when I was doing this classification of anti-symmetric matrices. If I had not said the word gapped, and I should have written it, if I had not said that these were insulators I was talking about, then the topological classification would be completely trivial. It'd be a point, because anti-symmetric matrices, you just put down a bunch of real numbers, and you can contract those all to zero or something, okay? So what makes this an interesting classification is that you assume these lambdas, you know, were non-zero, and that's where the complex structures, that's where the interesting homogeneous space is. So everything disappears if you allow gaps to develop. So this is the study of deformation. No, this is purely a study of non-interacting Hamiltonians, but I'd say the frontier of this study is to think about adding interactions. So there are already some results on how the classification deforms in the presence of interaction. Okay, the last comment I wanted to make about these two classes is it is possible to ask what happens if you restore SU2 symmetry. So if you restore spin SU2 symmetry. So this is sort of a little bit in the spirit of your question, that it's not adding an interaction, but if you sort of turn off spin orbit coupling completely by making I think you can retain spin orbit coupling and still bring the system into a SU2 symmetry. And it turns out that if you force the system to be SU2 symmetric, it effectively changes the sign on the two symmetries from plus to minus. And instead of moving down the table, you move up the table. This is because in the presence of SU2 symmetry, the time reversal unitary operator can be broken up as a time reversal operator on the spin part, tensor time reversal on the other part. And since this squares to minus 1, and this one squares to minus 1, then this leftover part should square to plus 1. So if you force time reversal symmetry, or sorry, if you force spin SU2 symmetry, then it changes the direction of these arrows, and you move four steps around the table this way, and you end up here. And this is a case where pi 0 is 0. It's a connected space, so these two things somehow collapse together. So this is just a little example and exercise on how to use the table. Okay, so now Bott, you know, is responsible for this list from 1957, and now we can turn it into a table. So I've referred to this table many times. That was supposed to be point 3. Let me. And this is the first column of a table. So what I should write out here is I should write dimension here and symmetry here. And symmetries counts negative symmetries with square to minus 1. And here we'll have no symmetry. Here we'll have, say, T symmetry. Here we'll have T and TQ. Here we'll have any three. There might be some additional symmetries you could think of, like sublattice symmetry and so on. Here we'll have dimension 0, 1, 2, three. We could keep going if we were mathematically inclined and do condensed matter physics in all dimensions. Now, because of the dual relation between dimension and negative symmetries, this will be an O. This will be O, well, O cross O cross Z. And this one will be U over O. And then the rest of the table is easily filled in by this rule here, which I erased most of, that tells you how to add. This was the rule. It said you could add a 1 to the P and a 1 to the Q without changing anything. So that says we should just fill in the table diagonally. I say this was too large a box. Thanks. Okay. And so on. And now we can identify systems. For instance, a one-dimensional Majorana chain is here. P plus IP, PX plus IPY superconductors are here. If there's this is sort of spinless. If you have spin in the picture, PX plus IPY up plus PX minus IPY down would be in this box. The recent paper of Teo and Kane that I want to end with is in this box. It has three dimensions, but it also has three it's effectively unsymmetrical. And it's in three dimensions. So this would be, I think their material is bismuth, antimony, coupled with a superconducting proximity effect. So that would be in this box in the table. Okay, so far I've just talked about like the bulk state. The possible Hamiltonians for given bulk states are gotten by thinking about pi zero or deformation classes. But when you come to defects, you have to think about the higher homotopy groups of these symmetric spaces. So for example, if you want to do vortices in a P plus IP superconductor, which is a famous thing to discuss, you know. So now I'm on the last part. Part four, Majoranas. Let's consider this box in the table, P plus IP superconductor. It's known that there's a superconducting order parameter delta. And this order parameter, for energetic reasons, likes to be fairly constant throughout the bulk, but you can, by inserting a magnetic flux or whatever, you can create a vortex in delta. So typical things to think of here, examples of such physical systems, if you want to kind of pin this to something, would be you might have the nu equals 5 halves, fractional quantum Hall effect states, where, again, you might object that this is an interacting system and shouldn't be discussed in this context, but I think it's maybe due to Jane and Haldane that this idea of flux attachment to the electrons, so you talk about these composite fermions, and then the Hamiltonian does look free in that basis. Or another example, you know, would just be what I wrote here. The you know, just a literal superconductor where the Bogoliubov basis would be the Bogoliubov particles would be the ones we were regarding as the free, that the Hamiltonian was free in. Okay, now what you need to know about the vortices, these are, so in this example, these are like H over 2E vortices. Sometimes they're called half vortices. What you need to know about these vortices is that they are populated, they can be populated by a Majorana mode, which means in the Hilbert space, which defines the ground state of such a system, there are operators which act and toggle you from one ground state to another. You know, these operators are their own daggers, so you shouldn't think in terms of creation and annihilation, but you should think of terms of toggling back and forth between 2 to the n ground states, 2 to the n over 2 ground states as you apply these operators. And these operators are combinations of creation and annihilation operators for electrons around this vortex. And there's a crucial phase that comes in. The phase comes in basically because this is a vortex in the condensate, and the bosons that the condensate made out of are made out of electrical charge 2. And this 2 compared to the electrical charge of the electron 1 means that when you braid one of these gamma I's at this vortex around a gamma J at another vortex, when you braid it clean around and back to itself, its effect on, its the conjugation effect of that operator on these Majoranas is actually to introduce a minus one. So what braiding does, a full braid, I'll write it full braid because it's kind of a two pi turn. A full braid induces an action on the Hilbert space that takes gamma I to minus gamma I and gamma J to minus gamma J. And from this, it's pretty easy to figure out what the operator is that affects the full braid. It's simply the matrix gamma I gamma J. Because if you write down, if you just do the exercise, you'll see the minus one pop out. You know, if you write gamma I and you conjugate it by gamma I gamma J, and on the other side, gamma J gamma I, you count the number of transpositions, just one, and then everything cancels, so it's minus gamma I, and similarly if you have a gamma J there. So it's very easy to justify this. By the way, this can also be written as e to the pi gamma I gamma J over 2. So the only thing I want to draw your attention to about this braid operation is it has a very interesting non-abelian characteristic. Even if you only consider full braidings, which never move the particles, if we considered half braidings, we'd have a non-abelian symmetric group coming in. But even if you restrict your attention to compositions of full braidings, it's very easy to notice that if you write gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 2, gamma 1, this, oh sorry, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 2, gamma 3. So now we're imagining you have a chain of three vortices, and you first take this around, and then take this around, or possibly then do the other order. You'll see a minus sign comes in. This is the same as minus gamma 2, gamma 3, gamma 1, gamma 2, again, just by counting the number of transpositions. So this means that these two guys, which are in our group of state, of operators, these operators don't commute with each other. They anti-commute. Well, I just want you to remember that from the two-dimensional case. And then my last example is this box, which is a generic generic three-dimensional electron gas now that has no special symmetries, and it is made, you know, physically, it's proposed to make it by a superconducting proximity effect within bismuth and antimony. So, okay, so now we're in terms of the Gataev table, we're in the case of no symmetry, comma three dimensions. And we're going to use a 3D topological insulator with this superconducting proximity effect. And then this will have an effective description in terms of a Dirac Hamiltonian with now three mass terms. And the three mass terms will be the real part of the superconducting order parameter, the imaginary part, and some band inversion parameter. And now, because of this sort of three-dimensional order parameter, instead of vortices, which we had in two dimensions, it makes sense now to have hedgehogs. So we can find points in three-dimensional space where the order parameter is sort of spraying outward from it, this three vector. And again, it's Keough and Cain, you know, more or less explicitly solve the zero mode equations and argue more or less analogously as people argue in two dimensions that they're bound by Majorana states, gamma I, near any one of these hedgehogs. So you might think there are 2n of these hedgehogs in a sample. And what we should do then is think about what happens when we braid these hedgehogs. Maybe these hedgehogs with Majoranas bound to them are interesting quasi-particles. What happens if we move them around? Well, it's not just a naive matter of having a ball with pi 2 is important. I should have said that. So the important point about this space here, U over O, yeah, let me actually go back. I should have said this already in this box, is why are there vortices, you know, from the point of view of the Kataev table, okay? You know, why are there vortices in a two-dimensional superconductor? Well, if we go to O over O cross O, and we walk around a vortex, the idea is that this is sometimes called microlocal. You think of space as so big that even though your order parameter is not constant, you think of it as varying so slowly that you can go into momentum space at each of these points and think that as you move around a vortex, you're seeing a circular family inside what's called BO. This is called BO for shorthand. And pi 1 of BO is Z2. And that at least explains why you can get stuck, okay? But actually, vortices in a superconductor actually have an integer invariant. They can turn left or they can turn right. So you might ask the question, well, what went wrong with the Kataev table? And the reason that we got seemingly the wrong answer is the table is only accurate in telling you whether you can deform one gapless Hamiltonian, one gapped Hamiltonian to another, keeping it gapped. It doesn't a priori presume that the way you do it is the obvious way. The way you would want to, the obvious way to try to deform two superconducting Hamiltonians would be to change the order parameter delta. And there you'll run into this Z. You'll run into the fact that you can't go from left twisting to right twisting without going through zero. But it turns out that you can move through like a charge density wave state. There are other states that keep a gap that are more general deformations. And when you take those into account, the Z collapses to a Z2. So the Kataev table has to be used with caution. It may be, for instance, that there are energetic constraints that prevent you from seeing all possible deformations, and you'd be wrong to take these homotopy groups at face value. But now when we go to hedgehogs in dimension 3, the same discussion applies, but now it isn't pi 1. It's no longer loops around the singularity, but it's now pi 2 of U over O, which is of interest. And this is isomorphic to Z2. So we expect to see, and here we actually, in the physical example, we don't think there's anything richer. We don't think there's a Z there, at least in the general model. I think Keo and Kane introduce a small model with only 8 bands in which this Z2 does become a Z. But in general, in a general model, we think that there's a Z2 here. And now what we should think of is the configuration space. So we have to be clear what we mean by the configuration space. What the configuration space means is that these hedgehogs are now free to move around. They spin all around in space. But it's not just that, because the system is described not just by where the hedgehogs are. That's the zeros of the order parameter. The order parameter is effectively a non-zero sigma model which lands you in this symmetric space, U over O. And in order to talk truly about a configuration, you should say where the singularities are and what the whole function is. Yes?
I think I'm still confused about this Z2 versus Z. I mean, normally, with fixed field theory, if I think about solitons, I'd be thinking about maps from the sphere at infinity into the vacuum manifold.
Okay.
And here you're talking about the topology of the space of Hamiltonians.
Yes.
The space of Hamiltonians and the vacuum manifold for a fixed Hamiltonian seem to me, I mean, completely different notions. So why are we classifying solitons in a fixed theory by talking about the topology of the space of Hamiltonians?
Well, because it's sort of this picture that I was sketching here. It's because we think that as we go to a different point in space, we have effectively a different translation invariant Hamiltonian governing the system. It's not exactly true, but it's an approximation if we think that the superconducting order parameter is varying very slowly. I mean, this is essentially going to the cotangent bundle. I don't know.
Maybe you think of it as just classifying mass terms in some Dirac equation.
You don't say the mass is a function of the order parameter, and since the order parameter rotates, at lower energies, you can think of it as changing Hamiltonians in a free theory.
Exactly.
It depends on whether you think of these as the classical order parameters or part of your Hamiltonian.
Okay, so I should move quickly to the punchline because I've taken a lot of your time. In order to think of if we want to make a quantum computer, you know, using this state or something, we should think what happens when we move these hedgehogs around. You could call them, quote, braiding, but that's stretching the imagination a little, because braiding is usually reserved for point particles in two dimensions and not point particles in three dimensions. But we could still describe we could still think about the configuration space, which basically tells us every possible thing the order parameter can do with this number of singularities in the ball. Each of those is a configuration. So basically, the order parameter is telling you where the zeros are. Where the zeros mean the map here has become singular. And then it's telling you where the map is elsewhere. Now, as sort of a joint
physical system can have an odd number?
No, it can't. So there'll be two, that's why I drew six here. They're created in pairs out of the vacuum. I mean, if you had an odd number, then one would appear on the boundary. For simplicity, I'm just saying, you know, we have a bit of isolated bulk and nothing interesting is happening near infinity, so then we pair create the hedgehogs out of the vacuum, and now we think about moving them.
But there's an energy between them.
You're ruining my punchline. You're right, there's confinement energy. And this is the answer to the mystery which I'm...
We wouldn't call it solid.
Yeah. So far the whole story has been the work of Kataev and Ludwig and Kane and their collaborators, and actually some of it from Leon and Joel Moore and Cholong Chi, who's in the audience here. But the last little bit, we actually did a computation, just for practice, and our corridor at station Q, right across the walkway. And we computed pi 1 of this configuration space. Okay. And we found out that it was a group, I'll just call it G, which not surprisingly fits into an exact sequence. It maps onto the permutation. That's obvious because you can permute the hedgehogs. But then we figured out what the kernel of this group was. And the kernel of this group was a very boring abelian group. It was just a bunch of copies, one copy of Z2 for each hedgehog. Okay, that's what we computed. But Keo and Kane argue that the physical representation under moving these hedgehogs around in three dimensions is identical to the physical representation that we just discussed in two dimensions over at the other panel, the Braid group. So what we find is that the particle statistics the statistics is only projective. That is, what we seemingly have, I mean, at first it looks like a contradiction. What we seemingly have is this rather tame group seems to have a surjection onto a different group, G prime, which is an extension of the symmetric group, by a non-abelian group. It's called the extra special 2 group. It's the group generated by these gamma 1, gamma 2 things. Remember, I pointed out to you on this other panel that there was a minus sign here? That's the subgroup of things that don't actually permute the hedgehogs. That's called the extra special group, and the key is it's non-abelian. Now, admittedly, it's very mildly non-abelian. It just has this tiny, in fact, it's very much like the quaternions. If you take the group Z2 plus Z2, which is the group of generated by 180-degree rotations in the three coordinate axes in space, that's Z2 plus Z2, and you lift that to the eight-element group up in spin, that's the quaternion group with eight elements. And this is a non-abelian group, and this extra special thing is some simple generalization of that. So it was a bit of a shock, because normally you think that your group acts directly on the states, but here we find it only acts necessarily projectively, meaning you have to take a central extension of this group before it acts linearly. And it turns out that Frank Wilczek actually proposed this. He has an archive posting in 98, where he gives an example. Now, the example, it turns out, wasn't quite correct, but I think the main point of the paper is that, in principle, you should expect anion statistics to only be projectively represented in any dimension. I mean, he was thinking in dimension 2 at the time, but it was a general idea that one should not necessarily expect particle statistics to be linear. So he gave some example, which is actually related to his paper with Nyack, where he mistakenly asserted that this representation was, you know, that the ordinary braiding of vortices in a people's IP superconductor, the image of that representation was a central extension of the symmetric group. It's actually not. It's a little more complicated. But now we found an example where his basic philosophy is validated. And then,
but physically, it's because.
So this is exactly what Chetan said when we were struggling with this dichotomy. Is, you know, what's the reason? How surprised we should be? And I think it was Chetan who said that. Well, maybe we don't expect the overall phase to have much meaning because there's some large and non-universal amount of energy required when we pull these hedgehogs apart. So why should there be a universal phase? There's a string connecting them. It takes energy now. But I don't consider that a complete loss, that is, this explanation, because I think what it suggests is that we should try to prove a no-go theorem. We should try to prove that this confinement energy is a necessary feature of any model in three dimensions in which Majorana fermions can be trapped at hedgehogs. Because it's only the microscopic model, you know, that you analyze to give the tension, the string tension. I think it could go either way. It's not clear in my mind whether projective statistics is something to be frightened of, and you have to find a reason why it happened. I mean, like the string tension, or whether projective statistics will ultimately be generic, and we will see it in systems where energies decay exponentially when you pull the anions apart. Right now, I'm open-minded, but I think that's an interesting question. I think you're one of two answers.
So, in this case, you presume they have these strings. And you have the subgroup of the
Well, what can we do with it? You're asking what we can do with this? Little. I mean, this isn't a quantum, this is not a universal quantum computer. I mean, it's no better than the vortices in five halves. It's just as good. It seems to be equal to the vortices in five halves. If this has a higher gap, we could use it. I mean, it might experimentally be easier to use. Well, this should not matter, because the only place where these phases could be harmful to a quantum computation is if you were superimposing two different configurations, which seems impossible. In other words, overall phases, of course, are not measurable. But one has to be careful when doing interferometry experiments, because if you have some amplitude for two different legs of the interferometer, relative phases make a huge difference. So, but because there are energies involved, and you know there should be a super selection principle, you shouldn't expect to build an interferometer where the actual hedgehogs are in different places. That should be basically classical. One wouldn't be expecting to superimpose that. So I don't think that the fact that there are non-universal overall phases would be a hindrance.
Any more questions?